All right, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Next Generation.NET talk here today. I'm Bart Smet. I'm a software engineer in the online services division. I'll talk more about that tomorrow in my RX talk, what I'm precisely up to over there. But I've sort of been dealing with .NET ever since it came out, and even when it was in beta back in the 2000s. And so I really have a soft spot for anything related to .NET, and I'm one of the big users of the great technologies in the online services division nowadays as well. So I'm very pleased to have the opportunity here to talk about what's new in what's coming for .NET. So let's get started with sort of the summary slide for this talk. If we have to think about .NET as a number of things that we're adding to it or that are sort of changing, it would be those three things. First of all, we will see a technology called .NET Native, which tries to bridge the gap between native code performance on the one hand and the productivity of things like C# and Visual Studio that we're all used to. So that's the native aspect. Secondly, the openness is a very important thing as well. We have a whole bunch of things that are being released to the open. One thing that's very dear to my heart is Roslyn, or the compiler as a service .NET compiler platform. So we'll take a look at that as well. And finally, the cross-platform strategy is a third thing that's really important as well. Not only cross-platform with regards to everything Windows related, but also enabling you to actually build applications once and forever, you know, using technologies that you love and use every day, such as C# with things like Xamarin. So let's get started by actually drawing a mind map here. One little thing is that this talk is really a combination of all the things we announced at Build last week. And of course, I can't cram everything into a 75-minute talk. So I really invite you to watch all the videos on Channel 9 that go into much more depth in all the individual technologies. But the mind map that we sort of set out at Build is the following. So at the level of core.NET, we'll talk about two key aspects. I want to talk a little bit about the runtime, because there's a massive investment in everything related to the current CLR, with new enhancements to the just-in-time compilation, including support for SIMD instructions. I'll go in much more detail on these. And secondly, at the heart of .NET is, of course, also everything language-related. So we have the compiler as a service, the Roslyn project, now available for everyone to start playing with, to look at the sources, those kind of things. And that's really a petri dish as well that serves for language innovation, enabling us to build new language features much quicker and even have other people contribute to whatever is out there in the .NET compiler platform. Now, on top of that, we have, of course, the places where you can use .NET. You know, there's a little bit of an extension there. Everyone knows about, obviously, using .NET for Azure and Windows Server, and we want to make sure that .NET is really one of the greatest technologies that you can use to build cloud-scale applications. We have the Windows desktop with all your current investments into, you know, desktop applications, line of business applications. We have huge assets in there as well, like all of Visual Studio is using .NET and WPF and those kind of things. So that's a very important stack going forward as well. And then, of course, we have everything Windows Store related, whether it's desktop, you know, or, you know, more like tablet versus, you know, phones and those kind of things. That's where, you know, .NET for Windows Store is really a great option to build really powerful applications using the languages that you know and love, as well as the .NET framework. And finally, with the partnership with Xamarin, also using the same set of libraries, the same set of languages for different environments, including iOS and Android. Now, on top of that, we think of .NET as, you know, having a whole bunch of things that really serve this vision of devices and services, a whole bunch of technologies in support of that. Now, I won't be talking here today about things like cloud services, enhancements that have been made to .NET to support, for example, Azure Mobile Services, nor will I talk about things like application suspension in ASP.NET, which is also a technology that's been added to the .NET framework stack. But what we will be talking about is the rest of the things here, convergence between, you know, the different application models we have for Windows on tablets and the classic Windows runtime, as well as, you know, Windows Phone. And finally, native compilation, also known as .NET Native. And I'll spend quite a bit of time talking about .NET Native here today. And then finally, the cross-devices vision that I already alluded at with the Xamarin partnership in support of the iOS and Android stacks, where you can build a whole bunch of libraries once to span the three ecosystems that exist in the industry today. So let's get started by talking, and I will talk about .NET Foundation later. Let's get started by talking about the really core runtime enhancements that we're making in the next generation for the .NET framework. Now, if I have to summarize what's new in terms of just-in-time compilation, it's really to make sure that your hardware shines. Today's hardware is quite different from the hardware when we started building the just-in-time compiler all the way back in the 2000s. And over the course of the years, new just-in-time compilers have been added. You can imagine we started with x86, then x64 came, and later we had ARM. And those three pieces of software have sort of diverged and sort of have a long history of like different quirks in all of them. So it was really about time to revamp the entire just-in-time compilation stack to offer better performance, better battery lifetimes, those kind of things, as well as having something that's easier to move forward in the future. So that's what we have, a brand new just-in-time compiler for the .NET framework. And just to refresh our minds on what a just-in-time compiler does, as you know, when you write some piece of code in C#, Visual Basic, F#, you name it, any managed language, including managed C++ if you like, and that gets compiled by the front-end compiler into MSIL. Now, this little arrow that you see over here is the arrow that we'll talk about when talking about the .NET compiler platform, also known as Roslyn. So that's a pretty fat arrow today with a lot of APIs that you can build on and extend on. But let's not focus on that arrow right now. Let's focus on the last arrow, which is the step that the Common Language Runtime takes to take your MSIL code into assembler that the CPU understands. So that's where just-in-time compilation comes in. So one of the goals, of course, is to improve application startup performance. In fact, when I was in the WPF team, I was part of the performance team for a while, or actually closely working with them to improve startup for a whole bunch of things, including Visual Studio itself. And you know, believe me, the just-in-time compiler is a big chunk of that, that code, especially if you're not using things like Engine. So what characterizes a good just-in-time compiler? Let's start there with the key design points and then talk about what this new compiler gives us. So first of all, one measure or one quality that you can measure is the throughput of the compiler. How fast does it generate code? And we want to really be not in the critical part of your application starting up. So good throughput is a very important thing to indeed go after. Secondly, well, the just-in-time compiler is really in a very bizarre spot of the world, right? Like, it needs to be there. It needs to be blazingly fast to generate code. But at the same time, the code that comes out shouldn't be crap either. So, like, if you compare that to what, for example, the optimizing C++ compiler does, which we'll talk about later with native.NET, that one is in a totally different spot. It can, use all the time that you take to get some cup of coffee to optimize the code. Nobody's waiting for the code to run. You're just waiting to ship the code off to some server or to some device. Just-in-time compiler needs to be fast both in generating code and sort of find the sweet spot in the code it generates that's also going to be fast. Secondly, or third, better, consistent performance. When we look at the just-in-time compilers we used to have for x86 and x64 and ARM, both sort of evolved from different code bases, and then, they sort of had different qualities to them. And we didn't really have this consistent performance across all of them. A good example is tail call optimization. There's a long history about supporting tail calls in the Common Language Runtime that at some point you had to know, like, well, the AMD64 JIT does support that particular case, but the other one doesn't, and so on and so forth. So by unifying that code base and really sort of making it a classic compiler architecture where you have as much in common as you can and then sort of specialize for different architectures at the last point in the compiler, we can actually make the performance much more consistent. And finally, a predictable performance as well, meaning giving it a whole bunch of different kinds of input, what are the outliers to the time it takes to just-in-time compile something. For example, if you slightly change a little piece of code, like what's the impact on the output, and is the performance still predictable under changing the code ever so slightly. So those are key qualities that we don't want to do any worse at than what we already have, of course. And so here are the current results for CTP2. In fact, we have new CTPs already, but this is a snapshot in time of CTP2. The code name for the project is actually called RyuJet, R-Y-U-Jet. I'll explain this name in just a moment. It sounds a little bit funky. It's even funky to pronounce, but it has a very good reason to be there. But what you see here is the performance of a bunch of applications, including Roslyn, all the way on the left. And you see Roslyn gains about 21-22% speed up by simply running with the new just-in-time compiler. You see some other things over there that are slightly worse. We're still looking at, you know, what those outliers are, but you know, the majority of things is actually faster using the new just-in-time compiler. Everything in the gray area is sort of, you know, the dark zone of you know, statistical noise, so we don't really have to worry too much about that. But generally, like, great performance improvements, and I'll show you that in just a moment. So one of the things that RyuJet actually wants to enable is have this new platform that we can enable a whole bunch of optimizations on. Like, you know, rewriting a whole just-in-time compiler, you don't just do it because it's academically pleasing or it's a fun exercise to do. You want to get out something at the end that puts you in a better position than where you were before. And one good example there is an often requested feature called SIMD support. SIMD stands for single instruction multiple data, which is certain CPU instructions that can really leverage, you know, parallelism in the chip itself. And we'll talk about that in a moment in more detail. Secondly, a whole bunch of Dragon Book compiler techniques can be applied. And that's where the name RyuJet comes in. For those of you who've ever taken a compiler course, one of the masterpieces on compilers is actually the book written by Aho, Seti, and Ullmann. And actually, there's a fourth one that I don't know the name of anymore at this point. Has recently joined. I believe it's Lady. But that's actually the Dragon Book, because on the cover it has a big dragon, because compilers tend to be like dragons that you have to tame. RYU is actually a Japanese word that stands for a certain kind of those dragons. So RyuJet is actually named after dragons. So that's where that comes from. But more importantly, the new compiler actually enables us to do a whole bunch more compiler techniques, because it's much, you know, it has a much different structure that enables us to plug in a whole bunch of optimizations. Floating point performance is another thing we want to go after for a lot of numerical algorithms, things like gaming engines, those kind of things. You want to have great performance with regards to floating point computations as well. And right now, you can actually download RyuJet and actually install it on your machine. It's just a copy of one file, really, in an MSI with a couple of like settings here and there, but it's really almost a plug-and-play thing, and I'll show you how to enable it in just a moment. Right now, it's only available for x64. The team decided to actually focus on one particular architecture first, even though like all the other stuff is in the oven right now. But people want to build stuff on top of this. And you know, we're not completely done with the other two architectures, but you can see that come out quite soon. So let me actually give you an example of the performance improvements you can see when installing RyuJet. So what I have here in just the command line is a set of demos. And the demos are called JIT. Now in here, I have a subfolder where I have an example of RyuJet. And that's just the regex64 example, which is a 64-bit compiled application that simply does some regular expressions. What's on the screen doesn't matter that much. There's some huge regular expression here at the bottom from the RFC 822 specification for emails. And you can see it's a pretty long regular expression. Now, what regular expressions do is the regex library will actually leverage just-in-time compilation of your compiled regexes to generate blazingly fast IL code. The unfortunate thing is that the time it takes to compile that IL code is actually quite long. So if you run it multiple times, you know, it sort of tends to get okay performance, but there is a big overhead in actually compiling those guys. So when I click do it over here, you see we're going through 500 iterations of the first regex, 5 of the second, 20 of the third, which are kind of small regexes. And then the RFC 822 email one, well, you know, that will take about a minute to actually get through that. So I'm not going to stand here and sort of, you know, hand wave at it. In the meantime, let me enable RyuJet over here. Now, the way to enable our UJIT is simply by setting an environment variable that dates all the way back in its prefix from the earliest .NET days when it wasn't called .NET but COM+. So you have to set COM+ underscore alt JIT for alternative JIT and set that to asterisk. And that will actually search for a file called protojit.dll, which contains the prototype of the just-in-time compiler. Now when I run the same application, and the other one is still going at the same time, when I start regex64 over here, you see our UJIT is on at the bottom. So it's detected that indeed the new JIT compiler has loaded. You see on the right-hand side it finished in 52 seconds for that last expression there. Right now in our UJIT it takes 291 milliseconds to do exactly the same thing. And you see we've gone down for a total there of about 1 minute to less than 2 seconds. So huge performance improvements in the new JIT compiler, as you can see over here. And for significant code bases like Roslyn, you get something like a 20% speed up for you know, a lot of cases. So that's one example of using our UJIT. I have another example here, and I'll show this one in a moment in somewhat more detail. I have the Mandelbrot application, which simply draws, you know, as you can see over here, the Mandelbrot fractal, and it takes about like 1 second to actually draw that thing with the new compiler turned on. If I disable the compiler, the new JIT compiler over here by disabling this environment variable, it takes a little bit longer. We come from 1 second something to 2.6 seconds here. So for this, there's also a huge improvement. But that's only the tip of the iceberg, of course, because this thing is a great segue to start talking about SIMD support, which is really good for numerical algorithms and graphical stuff as well. So let's switch back to the slides and talk a little bit about, first of all, where you can download this stuff. We have a whole bunch of those aka.ms URLs now, so you can simply put whatever I'm talking about here after the slash and you will find it, like, you know, whether it's our UJIT or later the Roslyn compilers, you can find all kinds of stuff over there. Now, one important thing to point out here is, you know, substituting a compiler is really doing some heavy surgery on the common language runtime. And there's a lot of code bases we can test this on, obviously. We have Visual Studio, we have a whole bunch of things in Azure, we have Windows PowerShell, we have a ton load of applications. But of course, you know, the team is always interested in seeing your results as well. So if you try this out and you find, you know, oh, this thing has regressed performance or this thing has, you know, behavior that's slightly different, the team really wants to know. So please send email to rujit@microsoft.com if you encounter anything that you think the team should know about. So let's talk about SIMD support. So what's SIMD all about? It's about doing parallel computations on a single chip, effectively. As opposed to scaling things out across different cores, SIMD is a bunch of built-in CPU instructions that enable scaling within one core. So it stands for single instruction multiple data, and it's actually been the top .NET requested feature on user voice. A lot of people really want this. The guy over here is talking about numerical math libraries, and that all makes a lot of sense to actually support that. Of course, the biggest problem with things like managed languages is like you can do changes to, as he suggests over here, to the C# compiler, but if you just make the change over there, it won't work because like that thing doesn't emit machine instructions. You really need your just-in-time compiler to support it as well. And so that's what our UJIT now enables us to do, is plug in those great, you know, new CPU instruction supports as well. So what does it mean to enable parallelism with SIMD? So here's a little picture that we copied from Ars Technica that illustrates this very well. On the left-hand side, you have SISD, single instruction, single data. And what SISD really is you get an instruction stream and you're kind of zipping it together, like the zip operator in Link, with a bunch of data. And so the instructions and the data get paired up and you get out, you know, a single stream of results. Now in SIMD, you have a single instruction that can deal on multiple pieces of data at once. So you get multiple data streams in, multiple data streams out, single instructions coming in. And so that's where you can actually start doing vector mathematics. You have a vector that contains a bunch of values, you feed it through the SIMD instruction and out comes a new vector with the transformed values. So that's really the basic idea. Now, of course, goes without saying that this can actually boost performance quite heavily because you're no longer relying on parallelizing things at the level of software and sort of like multiplexing and demultiplexing things onto multiple CPUs. In this case, you just send, you know, instructions all the way down to the silicon on single cores that can do, you know, those SIMD instructions really efficiently. So what we have right now is support for SSE and SSE2 in the CTPs that you can download. The team is working on AVX support as well, and I'll show you that in just a second, what the results look like. But the results are really good. So SSE2, you can actually expect up to a 4x speed up for algorithms that take advantage of those vector types. And the abstraction I'll just look at in just a moment, but the core abstraction is a vector of T that you have to use in your code to leverage those SIMD instructions. For AVX, we see speed ups up to 8x, actually. So I'll show both of these. AVX is newer, so your hardware has to support it. And as I said before, the current CTP does not include all the support yet, but you can start playing with it and already see quite some speed-ups. So what's the goal of enabling SIMD? Well, we don't want people to have to know whether you have to, you know, write things for a certain architecture with CPUs that do or do not support, you know, those instructions. We really want, you know, your code to automatically scale. So we want to give you an abstraction that you just program against without knowing about the machine that the code will run on. And, you know, worst case, it will just do stuff, you know, in an inefficient manner, but not less efficient than, you know, what you would have if you would write this thing by hand and not leverage parallelism. If you land on a machine that has SIMD support, things look really, really awesome. Now, the one abstraction that we need then is actually a CPU agnostic design of a vector type with variable length. Now, the variable length is because, well, certain CPUs have more registers that they can use for SIMD instructions than others. So we have to support variable length. But the abstraction that the team landed on in system.numerics.vector, which can be downloaded from NuGet as a library, is this one. You just have a vector of T, where T has to be a struct, and that supports things like ints and floats and those kind of things. And then the only thing that's really leaking out what, you know, the length is of arrays that or vectors that are supported by your CPU is this static int length get-only property that you can go at and sort of ask before you start populating your vectors, how many slots do I have available? And you can say like, oh, this thing has 8 slots, so let me fill up a vector with 8 values. And then I can really do blazingly fast things like additions, multiplications, and what have you of those vectors. Okay? So adding 2 vectors is no longer like looping through all the elements, you know, pairwise and adding them up. It's the hardware that does 2 vectors, add them together really fast. So let me show you an example over here. So in good old code, you may say, well, let's just call get values, call get increment over here, and then, you know, get a float array and sort of pairwise start adding those guys up. So I really want to have some loop, and you can already see a for loop means CPU cycles with branching instructions, those kind of things. So this is really a code-driven loop. It's not a data-driven loop that's going on here. So we're just indexing into that thing and starting to increment each value of that particular array with a certain value. Now, at the bottom here, we do something quite different. In fact, you know, I'm not using the result at the top there. If I would want to use the result as well, I would still have to copy it into the different array, but you can imagine what that looks like as well. Now, at the bottom, it's quite different. Get values and get increment both return vectors. And those vectors actually contain both, of course, the values and the increment for each value that we want to add. And now we can simply use the binary plus operator that becomes a JIT intrinsic. The just-in-time compiler knows about vector addition and they'll use SIMD instructions to actually enable that. So what we get is performance gains, and here's some example of, you know, scalar, which means we're just dealing with individual elements, of course, versus vector arithmetic, or, you know, using the SIMD instructions with SSD2 and SIMD, and this is actually the Mandelbrot render time that we looked at just a moment ago, and I'll go into the demo right now to actually show the different sort of optimizations that you can see in practice. So that's the second example here in the JIT folder called Mandelbrot. So what I want to do is, well, first of all, because I'm going to run some script here, I need to elevate this thing as admin, actually. I should not forget to do that. So let me just navigate over here as well. And let me first show you Mandelbrot bin debug. It's just a WPF app, actually. Here we go, debug Mandelbrot.exe. This is how the app looks like. It will do a fly-through through Mandelbrot fractal. And it's all written using WPF, using just all the standard stuff that you can use. So when I click begin on this thing, what we see here is something that doesn't look very smooth, but we're flying through a Mandelbrot fractal, which does a whole bunch of vector arithmetic without using vectors. Okay, like it's just a whole bunch of arrays being transformed and whatnot. And you see, like, you know, it takes some time to actually fly through this thing, and ultimately we end up at the destination, which looks, because it's a fractal, pretty much the same as where we started from, right? And this took about like 17.2 seconds, okay? Now, without any of the new Rootjet stuff, I could, in best case, you know, do some multi-threading, you know, and rewrite my application and leverage some things like task parallel library and so forth to compute the pixels in parallel. And I could do that over here by turning on multi-threaded. Remember, we came from 17 seconds, but now I'm wasting all the cores in my machine, in this case 8, to actually get a speed up of maybe a factor 3 to end up with 6 seconds. So, like, I'm not leveraging anything in the silicon that can make this thing really go fast. I'm just using more silicon, right? So, as opposed to doing that, let me actually call start window here, which will enable our UJIT. And you can see now it's the same application, but it says our UJIT is enabled. Now, with just enabling our UJIT, you actually end up with a speed up already, because the code that gets generated, even for those naive kind of array operations and so forth, is a little bit better. So we see we end up with 9 seconds or something without really changing my code at all. It's the same code running here, it's just faster. And of course, I wouldn't be here to show you that if that's the end of the story here. Now, there's a couple of other things we can do here that are really cool. I could enable SIMD instructions. Now, when I enable SIMD instructions, the fact that we're using vectors in this particular piece of code, by default, it falls back to, you know, just doing, you know, plain old stuff. If I select SIMD over here, we run exactly the same code, but using factor of T instead of using arrays. So when I enable SIMD using those built-in vector types in system numerics, you see that we go down to 3.35 seconds over here. It's a lot faster. We come from 17. I haven't even wasted silicon here. I didn't enable multithreading. If I want to, I could just, you know, for good measure, throw in some multithreading on top of this thing as well and compute, you know, some vectors in parallel, still using my two cores and getting it down to 1.5 seconds. So you see quite significant speedups. Now, the best is yet to come, because this is just using SSE2 instructions. My machine supports AVX as well, which is a new set of instructions that we're still working on, but this one has now copied a new preview of our UJIT that supports AVX instructions. We took away the multithreading here because it doesn't make sense anymore to use multithreading. It will take longer to spawn up the different threads than to execute the code. But so when I click SIMD over here, we take 0.78 seconds to actually do exactly the same thing. So that's what SIMD looks like. The usage is really simple. You just use those vector types and you take advantage of all the operator overloads that those vectors have, addition, multiplication, whatever, a whole bunch of arithmetic operators that are built in. So that's all there is to tell about just-in-time compiler enhancements. You can start playing with all of this with simply downloading our UJIT CTP3, and then you go and install the NuGet package over here called Microsoft BCL.SIMD, and that gives you the SIMD instructions. You will take a look at the IL code, you will actually be disappointed. The IL code doesn't contain much. It simply has JIT intrinsic attribute on all of those operators, meaning the just-in-time compiler is the one that will provide the implementation of plus and all of those things at runtime to support whatever your CPU actually supports. All right. So now that we've seen how we can actually make just-in-time compilation much better, let's talk also about a different angle that we can take .NET at. And both of them are really complementary. And this is about .NET native. So just-in-time compilers are great if you have a lot of code that you're generating, dynamic code gen, things like regular expressions, taking advantage of taking strings at runtime into, you know, efficient state machines, or even doing things like system.link.expressions to generate, you know, expression trees and compile them at runtime for dynamic code execution scenarios. But there's a lot of cases where, you know, you don't really need just-in-time compilation because you can simply take your application and compile it all the way down to CPU instructions that are super efficient at compile time. And in fact, now that we have this new vehicle of like stores with the Windows Store and the Windows Phone Store, why can't we just take that compilation step into the cloud and basically emit exactly the code that you want to execute on those devices? Not to spend any time, including engine time, on devices that are battery and power constrained. So, and that's all what .NET Native is really about. It's like getting the performance of raw native code with the productivity of C Sharp and Visual Basic and F Sharp and all the languages that you love and use. So let's talk a little bit about .NET Native. Now, first of all, what we've seen just a moment ago is the typical dynamic code generation scenario with an optimizing JIT. And we've seen how we took the JIT to the next level with things like RUJIT, okay? That's like benefiting all of the code you have out there today, things in the cloud, WPF applications, all of those things can take advantage of RUJIT. Now, in the case of Windows Store devices and Windows Phone Store devices, there we've sort of evolved in slightly different way. We said, first of all, well, we can engine things on the device so that every time you stand up the application, you don't pay the cost of JIT compiling it over and over again. So, you know, that improves the cold startup time. Later, we moved to this hybrid model of MDIL and engine in the cloud. MDIL is an intermediate language with all the metadata instructions and all of that stuff available. But when you upload your application to the Windows Phone Store, we will actually do cloud compilation of the application in the store and then send down the compiled binaries onto the devices. So you don't have to really spend that much time on the device anymore. But there is still, you know, some engine going on and those kind of things. But it's like getting better, you know, like less battery spent on the device and so forth. Now, with .NET Native, we can actually take all of that stuff in the cloud and really beam down, you know, tailor made, you know, binaries for those devices. And that's really what .NET Native is all about. So let's take a look. In short, it's really the next generation compiler in the cloud for managed applications that run in source, whether it's the Windows Phone Store or the Windows Store. The goal is to highly optimize those guys. As I've mentioned many times by now, like, you know, one of the constraints of typical devices like tablets and phones is really battery power and, you know, all the CPU cycles that you can be wasting doing other things. And, you know, the store is a great vehicle to deliver things. So, like, you know, if we can optimize something in the store, you know, we can send down highly optimized things to the devices. As a side effect, you know, we also get a converged developer experience across devices. Like, once we invest in this, you know, general purpose cloud compiler technology, you know, we can actually make that work for both phones and for tablets, for example, and, you know, sort of have the same set of APIs and the same, you know, level playing field, really, going forward. So what does it have to obey to? Just like we looked at the characteristics we want out of a good JIT, what do we want out of something that does cloud compilation to native code? Well, first of all, we want to be fast and small, okay? We want to be fast, meaning we don't want to be doing JIT compilation because we already know the device we will be running on. We can sort of optimize things ahead of time. And so the way we get to fast code, besides not needing any just-in-time compilation step, is that we can use cloud CPU cycles to actually run the VC++ optimizing compiler that we use for native code as well. So we can spend a lot more time, not developer time, but time in the cloud to optimize the code before we send it down to the device. Things you don't want to do in your development cycle because, like, you don't want to sit there, press F5, and get a cup of coffee before, you know, you hit your breakpoint. And you don't want to do it on a device either because of all the constraints that I mentioned before. Now, in addition to that, we also want to have a lean runtime. We don't want to be loading a lot of, you know, stuff that we don't need. Like, we don't want to be loading the just-in-time compiler, which is already a separate DLL. We don't want to be loading a whole bunch of things that don't really matter over there. The only thing we really need is a memory manager, a garbage collector, because, well, in .NET, you know, you allocate memory at free, and, you know, you never sort of have to deallocate the memory yourself. So you still want to have, you know, the garbage collector, and that's really sort of the core component of the CLR that's been factored out. In fact, it was always quite well factored out to actually now run in the smaller runtime, which is only like 300k large in terms of the DLL size. So how do we get the productivity of C#? So what we want is this convergence. I already alluded at that. We want to have first-class developer experience in Visual Studio. And guess what? When you hit F5 in Visual Studio for those applications using .NET Native, we will simply run the application using the JIT compiler on the desktop. Like, you know, we have that thing. It should produce exactly the same output. And you get your great development experience by hitting breakpoints, not having to sit there and see, like, a breakpoint not being hit because code is optimized and those kind of things. So we can really enable a great experience using whatever we already have there in store. And then we can come up on top of that with a simple solution to do packaging. Packaging meaning you simply want to be able to right-click, submit to store, and that's the end of it, really. Sort of have a self-contained package that ultimately ends up on the device. So we want to sort of have a very simple way of doing that. And then finally, once it's in the store, we can enable cloud compilation to send those binaries down to the devices. Now, today, we're not using CPU cycles in the cloud to do this stuff, except for what's already out there. In the preview bits that I will be showing you, you are doing this compilation on your machine. The whole tool chain is installed in Visual Studio and enabled when you actually use release builds. So if you do debug builds, it's blazingly fast. When you do release builds, it's using that whole tool chain to optimize your code locally, and you're really debugging a native application on your client. And it's quite likely that you will actually still have that option once we do the cloud enablement of all of this, because you want to be able to see whether your app, you know, the wheels won't come off when you start running it in native, of course. But that should not be the case. So here's the Visual Studio experience. Once you install the CTP, you just go to your Windows phone or Windows Store app. You right-click, you say enable for .NET Native. And then the last thing you have to do is change your config around to whatever architecture you want to build for. And of course, in the cloud, we can do that for you. Like, we know what's on the other side. Somebody wants an ARM version of this, or an x86 version, or x64 version. But if you do it manually today, you have to build for the different architectures yourself, because of course, it's no longer IL code at the end of the day. It becomes native instructions. So how do we then get the performance of C++? We've seen the productivity of C#. We get, like, you know, great, you know, debugger support, all of that stuff, simple right-click experiences. How do we get the performance of C++? So we want to generate code that's tailored to the device. That's one thing. We want to have faster app startup time without JIT or NGINE, as mentioned before. We want to have a lean common language runtime. Actually, it's not called the common language runtime in this setting. It's actually called the MRT. And we want to have faster code execution. And the way we can enable that is, like, if we go to native code anyway, like, why don't we just reuse what we already have? We have a great compiler that's compiling virtually everything. Windows, Office, SQL Server, all of that stuff is built. The CLR itself is built using this Visual C++ compiler, which has a highly optimizing backend. So the only thing that we really have to do is, like, you know, translate IL instructions at some level into something that looks like what the front end of the C++ compiler would emit, and then use whatever we already have in the C++ optimizing compiler. And that's really what the tool chain does. It uses the VC++ optimizer. So what do we have today? We have a couple of apps already in the store that use .NET Native to sort of give it a spin. One is actually Wordament, where you can see we got about a 40% speed up and a 12% decrease in memory usage. There's a bunch of other applications that are sort of giving this a try as well. And without much further ado, let me actually show you a quick demo of .NET Native. Now, the demo will be very disappointing. I'm just going to right-click and enable .NET Native. So, I've warned you. Like, you know, I'm not doing anything fancy here. So let me just create a new project here. Let me go to a store app and create a Windows app here. Just a blank application, call it app1, that's fine. And the only thing I really need to do here is just enable .NET Native. So once you install the SDK, you can actually right-click here, enable for .NET Native. And then the next thing, that's not the final experience, by the way. The final experience will likely look quite different. But what you see here is a little HTML page or MHT page that contains a little bit of information about how to enable it further. Like, you know, the integration is not completely there yet, so it guides you to the steps that you have to take. So what are the steps? Well, first of all, you go to your solution and you change the build settings over here to say, for example, release x64. Now, at this point, I can hit F5 and I will just see my classic experience, you know, that doesn't take a lot of time to actually build. Let me actually do that anyway. So I can just hit F5 on this thing and you know, well, okay, when you're giving a demo, it takes 1 second longer than it typically takes. And as you can see, like, you know, everything is just working fine, and I can just close this application here. So nothing special here. I don't know what those numbers are from, actually. First time I see these. What? Oh, I see, it's still running. I see. Oh, yeah, exactly. That's the whole suspension stuff. Yeah, okay. So, okay, I have my app there. I closed it down now by just hitting the stop button. Now, when I go back here and I change this into release x64, it will take a little bit longer to actually run because it's going to run the whole optimizing compiler on top of the output as well. Now, one more thing I need to do to enable this is double-click properties here, and I can go to build, compile with the .NET native toolchain. Now, as I build this, just watch at the bottom, it will take, you know, quite a bit longer to actually go through all of those motions. But at the end of the day, I'll end up with some very small deployment. I will actually end up with two files. I will end up with a file called app1.exe and app1.dll. App1.exe will be 1-2 kilobytes maybe. The only thing it does is just transfer control into the DLL. And the DLL is a completely self-contained thing that doesn't depend on anything. Because what's really happening in .NET Native is that we take all of the things that you're using from all of the different places in the .NET framework and whatever, we put all of those things together, then you get a gigantic set of assemblies, and then there's a big-ass tree shaker algorithm that's going through that to shake off everything you're not using, and this thing ends up being like a 2 megabyte thing that contains everything, as opposed to, like, you know, loading a whole bunch of assemblies. So as I hit F5 on this guy, it will actually just run fine. Now, when I go to the debugger, it runs fine, but it's not doing anything, like, you know, no surprise there. But when I go to debug Windows modules, what you see here is something quite interesting. You see all of those .NET DLLs are still listed. Things like system.reflection, system diagnostics, you have it, it's all there. But it says, I'm embedded in the module of app1.dll. Really, the only things that are here are app1.dll and app.exe. So let me actually just open up under Tools the Process Explorer, SysInternals Process Explorer, and show you what this looks like in terms of the modules loaded. That takes a little bit of time. In the meantime, let me navigate in this command prompt here to that folder where I created my application. And I want to show you one more thing there. So when I go to app 1 here, and you would go through this list, it's cut off a little bit on the left, I can see behind me here. But like as I drag it out, you don't see clr.dll here at all. One thing you see, though, is over here, mrt100_app.dll, and it says Microsoft.NET Native Runtime. That's actually the .NET Native Runtime that's been included with my app. And if I would actually go to the File Explorer here, you see it's 292 kilobytes. Now, if you want to go a little bit further and you want to explore this at your own pace, you can actually go in here and do a couple of fancy things as well. One fancy thing you could do, and you could sort of start digging a little bit deeper as you go, is you could use dumpbin to dump the binary and actually take a look at the imports of my app.dll, app1.dll. And you see, those are all the things that my DLL imports, and there isn't that much, you know? Like, it looks like quite a bit of things, but in reality, like, if you compare this to, like, a gigantic application using a whole bunch of class libraries, this looks really very, very lean. And the only thing you see is some imports of the .NET runtime or the .NET native runtime with things like, you know, traces from a garbage collector being there, wait for GC, those kind of things, which are still in the runtime, obviously, in the shared DLL for the runtime. But other than that, like, everything has been compiled into this executable. Now, just to show you the toolchain, we can go up a couple of levels here, and I can just try to build this thing using MS Build, okay? So let me first clean my folder just to show you what it looks like if you do a clean build. So let me clean this thing for configuration equals release and platform equals x64. And let me just clean the output. So now it's all gone. And now let me rebuild this whole thing like this with release and x64. Now what you see going by really fast here, this first thing, was really something that doesn't quite work, and that's because I'm using it still. Why do I keep using things? Is it still running now? Ah, there it goes. It's gone. So let me rebuild it. The thing you saw going by blazingly fast is just the classic C# compiler emitting IL code. That thing has even gotten faster because in this case I'm using the Roslyn compiler with the new JIT and everything. So that thing has sped up quite a bit. But what you're seeing happening now is actually the .NET native toolchain taking the IL code and transforming it a number of times into something that the optimizing C++ compiler can use. And in the middle there, you see it took 24 seconds here to do all of that stuff. In the middle, you see the shaker actually at work, you know, doing a whole bunch of steps here. Well, the tree shaker is one part of this, but like, you know, you can see a whole bunch of things that it's doing over here, including enabling certain things like reflection. Well, if you shake everything off your DLL that you don't need or that we can't prove that you need, things that you may want to reflect on sort of are kind of an exception to the rule, because like maybe you want to dynamically load some type. So those are the kind of things that we have to use heuristics for, and this is sort of where I want to leave it off. There's this one thing here called default.rd.xml. That's something we'll talk much more about later, but like when you use libraries that use a lot of reflection, you may have to give us some hints about the things you're reflecting on. And we're still evaluating like the way to really enable that, like, you know, run your application, profile it at runtime and see the kind of things you dynamically load by default and sort of include those in the package as well. But most likely this is just going to end up with things like Newton's of JSON and things sort of having certain attributes apply to them to say, like, you know what, when you use me, I want to reflect on a whole bunch of things. Please make sure that stuff doesn't, you know, get stripped out by that tree shaking algorithm. But as you can see, for a lot of applications, you can actually get a huge win in terms of both performance as well as memory usage with .NET Native. So that's the second thing, and I want to emphasize here that like both approaches of the just-in-time compiler, where we do a huge investment, as well as .NET Native, which has a huge investment, are complementary. Like, we don't believe the world is black and white. Like, you don't want to compile everything to Native, and you don't want to do everything using a JIT. Now, there may be some cross-fertilization here. Like, in certain cases, it may make sense to actually pay the price to do a JIT, a highly optimized JIT. In certain cases, it may make sense to even, you know, natively compile cloud applications. Like, right now, this is completely constrained to Windows Store apps, but there's definitely things that are being considered going forward, like where we could actually take .NET Native technology beyond just the use for Windows Store apps. Where can you get it? As I said, we have all of those aka.ms URLs, so you can simply go there, /.NET Native. There you can download it. It's currently available for x64 and ARM. x86 is coming, so like, you know, it's just a matter of prioritization there. But like, this is all CTP preview quality, but you can already start playing with it and see whether your own apps, you know, just work totally fine with .NET Native. One thing I don't want to spend too much time on here, like, because we talk more about the underlying stuff here in the runtime, is universal apps. Universal apps, you can read up a whole bunch about it. I think there's more sessions this week here as well. But universal apps, the goal there is really to take portable class libraries to the next level. Meaning that we get a more, you know, broad support for like more targets, like Windows Phone 8.1, obviously. The surface area of portable library is sort of growing, and it starts to include things from WinRT as well. So you can start building portable libraries in your applications that use certain WinRT APIs that you can start sharing across different applications, including Windows Phone and Windows itself. So that's really the goal there of the convergence, as we call it, the Windows convergence, so that you can really start sharing those components that you're working on across your different apps for different form factors. So that's really the unification there. Let me not do the demo of this one. You know, like, that's just right click, you know, and say like, I want to add support for Windows Phone 8.1 to this thing. Well, actually, I could just like escape and just do one right click here, right? Like, you know, just go to the app here and say, like, I want to add support for Phone 8.1 to my already created Windows Store app. And then, you know, at that point, we do a couple of like changes here to the project. And, you know, we end up with this little bit disappointing thing here. That's the reason I didn't want to show it, because I have some other stuff installed over here. But that's what the experience will look like, modulo the dialogue. And you can see on the right-hand side, what it sort of starts looking like is you get both the Windows 8.1 and the Windows Phone 8.1 projects over here referring to this, you know, sort of shared file or this shared folder that contains all the assets that both of them can start using. So that's really the convergence of all those experiences, making it possible to really write your code once and use it everywhere in terms of the Windows Store and the Windows Phone Store. Now, a couple more CLR enhancements. In fact, everything sort of so far has been either CLR enhancements or having a library in support of .NET Native. There's a couple more enhancements I'd like to highlight. In fact, I just want to talk a little bit about things that are intentionally blank. That's the goal of a garbage collector. So there's a little thing that we've added in .NET 4.5.1, which is called large object heap compaction. Now, it's a little bit debatable whether we should even talk about that, because in practice, only a few people that we know about have considered this to be a problem before. So let me just talk about it very briefly. The garbage collector has, you know, sort of learned a lot of tricks over the years, and it's gotten better every single time. Really, there isn't that much you have to do to make the garbage collector do its stuff. It's very good at sort of self-tuning itself. Now, that means that you shouldn't be calling gc.collect yourself. There are some exceptions to that rule, of course. Every rule has some exceptions, but generally, you shouldn't be calling gc.collect. Now, unfortunately, there are certain cases where quite pathological cases, quite frankly, where you can end up in some interesting issues. And one of them is large object heap not being compacted. Now, what's large object heap? So LOH, or large object heap, is a heap where any allocation in managed code that's larger or equal to 85,000 bytes goes to. And why do we have a large object heap? Because if we would have those things just in regular generation somewhere, well, your Gen 0 would be quite full immediately, that's one thing, and that object would start aging. Secondly, if you have large objects, in a lot of cases they live relatively long, but that's more like sort of putting, you know, a wet finger in the air and sort of saying, like, is that really the case? But secondly, they would be very expensive to compact. At some point, when that 85,000 plus thing dies, you have just a gap of memory sitting there, and you have to copy a whole bunch of things to fill that gap and start compacting stuff. So the large object heap never got compacted. Now, the one problem with that, of course, is like if you have a lot of stuff on the large object heap and those things eventually die, and you know all the gaps in the large object heap are just small enough for a new large object not to fit, then you end up with Swiss cheese, right? It's like fragmented. So in order to counter that, .NET 4.5.1 actually has a class called GC settings where you can actually tune that. Now, of course, you only tune that when you've proven 100% sure that you're suffering large object heap compaction. And in fact, the CLR team would definitely want to know in case you find one of those situations that are really legit and you can actually prove exactly that large object heap compaction is indeed the problem. Now, there are some known cases, but in a lot of cases, there's other stuff in the way, you know, that's not really making the large object heap being the problem. The only thing you have to do here is, you know, you set this enum to compact once. It's an enum, so like maybe, you know, we can have some more nuts and bolts in the future. Not that it's just compact once or many times. But like when you put it on with compact once, it means that the next garbage collection will actually also incur the cost of doing a large object heap compaction. And that will take time, you know, just to be aware of that. Like, you know, you will see a performance degradation when it's compacting the large object heap. But in case you actually suffer from that and you can't continue allocating stuff because you have Swiss cheese in the large object heap, then this now provides an escape valve. So that's one little thing that I wanted to toss in here before going to the next foundational technology, the .NET compiler platform. So I want to wrap up this session. We're far from done, actually, but I want to spend a good chunk of time on the compiler platform, because I believe it's really a key investment that we're making to really rewrite both the C# and the Visual Basic compilers all the way from the ground up. And just like with the just-in-time compiler, that's not something you just do for fun, you know, between the soup and the potatoes, as we say in Belgium. So why do we do that? Well, we want to have a couple of things. First of all, we want to be faster ourselves. Like right now, to add a language feature, you have to add it in three different compilers, believe it or not. You have the C# command line compiler, you have the compiler actually feeding the Visual Studio experience when you're typing stuff. Now that has different characteristics. A batch compiler needs to be fast for a lot of code. Compiler inside Visual Studio needs to do its darn best job to actually tolerate all the things mistakes you're making while you're typing. In fact, every time you're typing, your code is not complete, but per definition it will not compile. So that thing should not start flipping and like, you know, oh, red squiggly is everywhere, this, that, the other thing, like, you know, it shouldn't be in your face that you're still writing your code. So that thing has to do different stuff. And then finally, we have the expression evaluator in the immediate window and those kind of things. That's a third version of the same compiler that we have to maintain. So with the whole rewrite, we're really relayering all of the stuff that uses the compiler on the same code base, all written in C# and Visual Basic itself, C# compiler in C#, VB compiler in VB. So that's a great way of dogfooding everything, also getting a big code base that we can test the compiler on itself, of course. Like that's always compiler builder's wet dream is like to build the compiler with itself. And F# already did that, C# and VB didn't. And in addition to that, we not only get like, you know, a speed up in terms of like language and IDE enhancements, we can also open this whole API up so that third parties can actually extend the development experience in Visual Studio. Finally, all of this stuff is open source, so you can actually take a look at the entire code of the entire compiler of C# and Visual Basic. It's all there, open for people to actually play on it and, you know, add stuff, submit, you know, fixes, what have you. So what's the big picture? The big picture is this. Traditional compilers are black boxes. Some source code comes in. Some DLL or EXE comes out on the other end. A whole bunch of knowledge is inside that thing. There's a big brain there, but you don't get to see it. Like, you don't get to intercept anything. You don't get to play with it. So with Roslyn, that becomes an open box where everything that you have there is exposed as DLLs. You can simply add a reference to the Microsoft C# compiler DLL from your application and do stuff with it. Like, you know, you can build your own host for the compiler, you can ask the user to write a little piece of C# code and feed it to the compiler at runtime to compile it. You have it, like all sorts of things there. So where we're coming from is isolated and closed compilers that you don't get any intelligence from, and it's very hard to extend the development experience. Like, you know, simply going to Visual Studio and saying, I'm going to write a code refactoring here. Like, well, good luck doing that. Like, you know, a lot of people have gone through the pain of writing their own parsers, God believe it, like to enable that kind of stuff. So that should not longer be the case. Secondly, or where we want to go to, is first of all an open platform, meaning all of those libraries are open. You can play with them, you can use them, you can extend them, whatever. Secondly, we want to have rich IDE experiences building on top of that, meaning everything you see in Visual Studio, go to definition, find all references, refactor, rename, all of that stuff should be built using, you know, the compiler itself. Like, we shouldn't have backdoors in Visual Studio to enable anything. Like, everything should go to the same thing. Meaning that, you know, folks like Xamarin can actually use this compiler, and indeed they've integrated it in their development environment in a couple of days to actually rebase the whole thing using the Roslyn compiler behind the scenes. We want to enable rich code analysis scenarios. Like today, you know, writing your own FXCOP rule is incredibly hard. Like, you know, it should be possible to make it much easier using this. And also writing custom diagnostics, like as you see in Visual Studio when you implement an interface. Like, why should that be a privilege to us? Like, you know, you just type, you know, class foo colon I notify property changed, and then some light bulb comes up that says, oh, can I implement this interface for you? Well, sure, we can do that, but like, we want to build that using Roslyn and make it even possible for you as a toy project to build exactly the same thing or build something much more awesome than just that, of course. And that's custom diagnostics. And as I mentioned before, one of the design goals all the way when the project started like several years ago was to open source it eventually, and that's now happened, so you can actually find all of it on CodePlex. Now, by doing that, we really get like, you know, this magnifying effect. In the past, you know, there was just a lucky few that would actually implement some code refactorings and all sorts of tools that integrate with Visual Studio. We can get much more, you know, of partners that can actually build source-based tools that do transformations on them. And of course, you know, all the developers at the end of the day benefit as well, because we can get a bigger ecosystem around all of that stuff. So let's just try to create a little code diagnostic using Roslyn. So what I want to do here, first of all, is show you how you install Roslyn. When you download Roslyn, you will just get a zip file containing a bunch of V6 files in it, Visual Studio extension files. You can see three of them over here. You just install all of them. You just click all of them twice. That gets installed. And then finally, you shouldn't forget to run this one as well. Install the Roslyn preview into the experimental hive. That will set up a copy of Visual Studio. Well, not an entire copy, but like just a registry location that says, like, I want to have an experimental hive where you can load all of your extensions so that they don't interfere with, you know, your regular Visual Studio installation. It's like Windows Safe Mode, if you will, that sort of uses a different registry hive. So there we go. You install all of that stuff. And then, in particular, if you've installed the SDK project templates, you will get over here a new project type under Roslyn that enables you to create a diagnostic with a code fix. That's the one I want to try to build here right now. So let me start by just pressing enter here. And what I get is just, quite frankly, a little code diagnostic that's useless. But it sort of shows you how to get started. It's the hello world of Roslyn. And I think, you know, we'll come up with something slightly more compelling as the hello world. But what this thing does is it's a code diagnostic that gets loaded in the compiler. Okay, so all those diagnostics are actually exported using MEF over here. And the compiler will actually load those and see, like, what's the interface you implement. In this case, I'm saying I'm implementing a symbol analyzer. That means for every symbol in my code, well, not every symbol, only the symbols that I've declared to be of interest to me, the compiler will call me back and say, you know what, I found a symbol for you. Do you want to put your finger on that thing and do something with it? And we're saying yes. You know, we want to take a look at all the named types, like classes, interfaces that have a name. I want you to tell me about that, and then I can analyze the symbol over here. And what we're doing is looking over here for some certain naming pattern. We're saying, like, looks like you have a class over here that has a lowercase in it somewhere. I would like you to use only uppercases. Now, that's where the nonsense comes in for this particular example. It's like, that's kind of an anti-pattern. So I think we'll improve that at some point, maybe to suggest that classes need to start with an uppercase or that interfaces should start with a capital I. Like, that's something I could be implementing here quite easily. So, but this thing is just checking whether my symbol contains lowercase characters, and then it creates a diagnostic that it gives back to the caller, and the caller is a C# compiler here, to say, like, here's a diagnostic for you. That's something that I found out about the code and that you need to tell the user about. Now, that user could be the output of the C# command line compiler. It could be Visual Studio with red squigglies in the IDE. You name it, like, wherever the compiler is hosted from. So as I hit F5 here, we can actually see that this thing will be working, obviously. And then I will try to extend it to make it somewhat more meaningful. So it's loading some symbols here. If I go to Tools, under this Visual Studio copy that got started, under my debugger, like I'm debugging Visual Studio with Visual Studio, you can see that there's a diagnostic here that contains some text that was in my other project. And that thing has been loaded now. Now, as I open up some project I've prepared over here that just has a very small piece of code in it, you can see that I have a namespace, a class, and you know, some static void main here. And we see that program gets squigglies under it, saying, like, the type name for program contains lowercase characters. That's exactly the string that I was returning to my diagnostic just a moment ago. So Roslyn showed me this particular type in terms of, like, an object was given to me, and I analyzed it and I gave back some diagnostic. Now you also see a light bulb over here to suggest to make it uppercase. Well, where did it get that from? Well, the place it got that from is because my solution over here, I will stop the debugger in just a second, has also a code fix provider. And code fix providers give you those light bulbs. In fact, implement interface is just one of those code fixes now. Like, you know, the things that you have in Visual Studio are just, you know, implemented using that as well. Now, what you see here is as you hover over it, it gives you even a preview of what it's going to do. And that's because it called into my code where I said, I want to change this by making this all uppercase. And here you get a preview of what that looks like. When you click it, the change is actually made and the experience sort of flows on from there. You can sort of rename it throughout your entire application. You could automatically do that, all sorts of things. So let me undo that change because it's kind of nonsense. Close this instance of Visual Studio and then stop my debugger over here. And that's something that tends to happen when you're debugging Visual Studio with Visual Studio. So let's just ignore that. So if I go back here, oh, actually stop that. If I go back here, the code fix provider is here. And that's the one that was actually giving me the fixes. So you can see this thing returns a code action, which is a light bulb saying, make this thing uppercase. Okay? So that's sort of the playing field. Now let's try to make something nicer out of that. If you looked at my code just a moment ago, in my other Visual Studio instance, I had some if statements without curly braces around the statement bodies. And that can be confusing, especially if you have dangling else cases or dangling ifs. You may be confused, like, what code will execute under which condition. Maybe it's better to sort of suggest that everyone has curly braces around all the bodies of if statements and else clauses. So we can actually do that quite easily now. So let me start off by sort of butchering most of the code here and sort of, like, you know, first of all, get rid of my code fix at all. Like, I'll just keep one line in there that's useful. And I'll go to the diagnostic analyzer and also get rid of most of it, actually. I'll get rid of about half of it over here, you know, like just cut it in half, you know, that's always good. And then go to the top here, you know, less code is better. And let's get rid of the iSymbol analyzer because I'm not interested in looking at symbols. I want to be looking at syntax trees, like a little bit more bold, you know. So what I want to do here is I want to have an iSyntax node analyzer. And I have to say what kind of nodes, what the syntax kind is I'm interested in. So the syntax kind is simply called syntax kind, you know, and it lives in Microsoft CodeAnalysis.c#. See the light bulb over here? That light bulb is implemented using the thing I'm using to implement my own code refactoring here. So you know, it's all sort of like, you know, it's this typical compiler's dream, of course. In fact, I can get one more light bulb here to implement the entire interface. And I could build this one myself too using all of this. And you see the preview and all of that stuff. So I want to use that great technology to have my own refactorings here. Now, first of all, or code diagnostics. Let me get rid of this this whole set of strings here and just import things over here. I'm not going to drag and drop everything in. I'm just going to drag and drop this one in. And so my diagnostic ID is curly braces, some text I will render to the user, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, you can read all of that stuff. Now, what are the syntax nodes that are of interest to me? When does the compiler have to call me back to ask, like, do you want to do something with this? Well, the answer is I want to get my hands on, as you can see over here, syntax kind dot if statement and syntax kind dot else clause. Those are the two things I want to get my hands on. Now the compiler is going to call me back in analyze node whenever it encounters any of those two guys. So what I have to do here is sort of like case which one of the two is leading to me being called back. So let me create an if statement local variable that's casting the node to an if statement, oops, statement syntax over here and sort of check whether the if statement is not null. If the if statement is not null, we know that we have an if statement to analyze, okay? Now, we want some more conditions. We want to make sure that the body of the if statement is not empty. So what's the body of the statement? If statement dot statement. That's the, you know, the thing inside the if block, okay? That thing shouldn't be null either. And finally, I want that thing not to have curly braces. Now, how can I figure out, like, how do I check for curly braces, and for heaven's sake? So let me just open up something else you get when you install all of Roslyn. You can get over here the Roslyn syntax visualizer. And the syntax visualizer allows you to simply click on some note in the document over here, and it will navigate on the right-hand side in the Roslyn syntax tree, because this thing is using Roslyn itself, the whole code editor. So I can click here and click on the if statement, for example, and it highlights everything that has to do with the if statement. And we see at the bottom here that there is a block in my statement body. The block is what indicates that there are curly braces. In fact, if I get rid of those curlies over here and I just type return, say, and I click on the return statement, you see there's no block anymore. My if statement simply contains a return statement. Okay? So I want to find things that do not have a block statement inside of them. So that's quite easy. I can say over here, and not if statement dot statement, which is not null, is of kind syntax kind dot block. So if my if statement doesn't contain a block, then I want to complain loud and clear to the user. Okay? How do I complain to the user? I give a diagnostic back using the callback called addDiagnostic. So I call addDiagnostic here, and I want to create a diagnostic. How do I create a diagnostic? Using diagnostic.create. What do you pass in? The descriptor. What's the descriptor? That's that thing that Roslyn has already generated for me over here called the rule. The rule contains a bunch of things, like whether it's like what category is and so forth, so we can sort of enable verbosity levels, saying like only complain about things in the style category, whatnot. So I'm just going to put that rule in here. That's not what I wanted to copy. Rule in here. I need to give it a location, where to put the squiggly. So I'm going to say like, you know, the place to put that for the if statement is the keyword. And then for the if keyword, get me the location in the document. That will give me the text span where the if keyword is sitting. And then finally, comma, the message arguments, that should be filled into the message format string over here. And I'll simply say, in this case, if statements should be surrounded by curly braces. Now, I can do the same thing for else. So let me just copy all of that thing here. Else statement over here. This thing becomes an else class syntax. Else statement over here. Else statement over there. And then here the else keyword. Oops. Maybe better if I copy that else keyword over here. And then, you know, let's make this, whoops, else clauses. Okay? So now I have my diagnostic wired up. Roslyn should ask me about stuff. And when I hit F5, we can actually see our squigglies come into existence, hopefully. So as I click on Roslyn prep here, once more, the compiler is handing over its tree to me. And I'm now doing my analysis here. And lo and behold, come on, there we go. We have squigglies. Okay? So it says, oh, if doesn't contain curly braces. And this if doesn't contain curly braces. Well, you know, this else is kind of not the place where we want it, because else if is kind of a good pattern to support. So like we could change that, obviously, to say like else if is fine. Like, you know, if you have an else and it contains an if statement, then don't bother asking the user about that. But I still don't get my light bulbs either. So let me fix those two things. First of all, I don't want to have a warning for else if. And I should really stop hitting F5 and just use Control F5, because that dialogue is a little bit annoying. So I'll just say, if the else statement is not of kind an if statement, then I want to show the squiggly. So like else is only to be, you know, giving a warning if it contains a block, not a block expression, and not another if statement itself. Okay? So now how do I create my code fix? Go to the code fix provider over here, and start by basically looking at what we get. Well, we get the document, and from the document we can get the syntax tree's note, or the root actually. Now, we also have the span where the error occurs. So what can I do from that span? I can get the token where my cursor is. So I can ask, or where the squiggly is, I can actually ask, dear root, find me the token where that particular span is. Now, what's the token? That's going to be if or else. If or else belongs to a statement that's the parent of the token, because like the if statement contains the if keyword and then the condition and all of that stuff. So I need to go over here, span.start actually, the place where, you know, the token starts. I need to go from the token to the parent, okay? And then I will actually have the statement that we are analyzing. Now I need to check whether the token is of kind if keyword. Then I want to do one thing. If the token is of kind syntax kind else class, then I want to do something else. Okay? So in both cases I want to do something. I'm just going to copy paste some code here. The first thing I want to do is get the parent out. In the case of an if statement, it's going to be a different type of parent than in the else case, so that's why I need to disambiguate here. So this is going to be an if statement syntax. In this case, it's going to be an else class syntax. And now we're in business. We have our hands on the tree. Okay? Now what we have to do is we have to put a block around the body of the if or the else. How do we create a block expression? What about using a syntax factory? Okay? So syntax factory allows me to create anything. I can create else clauses, while loops, everything. So, you know, I can generate any kind of code here. Let me generate a block. What do I want to put inside the block? well, what's also already inside the if, but isn't a block, right? Like, you know, the thing that's already in the statement. So I want to get the statement statement, okay? So that's the body of my if or my else. Now I have a block. Now what do I do? Well, I don't want to lose my if, right, or my else. Like, I need to update that if or else with that new block. So the way to do that is by saying statement dot with statement of that new child. Now this thing doesn't update things in place, and that's where Roslyn has a deep immutability model. Like, everything in Roslyn is immutable. That enables us to do lots of things in parallel, have safe sharing across different cores and all sorts of things. Like, a lot of great things come from it. So what I get back is a new statement tree that basically contains a pointer to the old one and some new stuff inside of it, but the original one didn't get changed. So if multiple things concurrently are trying to do things, you don't end up in big trouble. So now I have my new statement. Now what's the last thing I need to do? Now that I have my new statement, I need to replace inside my document, I need to replace the old statement with the new statement, like this, and then I get, I get a new root over here, a new document root. So now I have a document that contains the change, and that's what the preview window will show me. It will actually show me, like, oh, here's the difference, like, you know, do you really want this? So that's the new root now. Now, finally, I need to return, as you can see, a task of IEnumerable of code action. So I'm just going to return an array here that creates a code action like this. And the description will be at curly braces. And what I need to pass in is the change document. How do I create a document? I say document with syntax root over here, like that. And I just pass in the new root. And now I have, you know, the new document being sent to the code action. Now let me just copy all of that stuff now to the other side, you know, just forgive me for doing some copy paste over here right now. And in the case, you know, it's none of those two, I'll just return null, meaning there's no code actions that you have to show. So now when I hit F5, we should first see else if being fine. I hit F5 again, I should have pressed Control F5. Oh well, whatever, you know, we'll suffer through that one dialogue one more time. So let me open Roslyn Prep. It's analyzing right now, like my code is being invoked, you know, as it sort of goes through the parse tree here. We see if, and we see a code action. And we see add curly braces, lo and behold. And what you see here is indeed that my refactoring is working. Now, my curly braces are kind of off to the left here, like, you know, that's not much use. But, of course, you know, we have a solution for that as well. It's called pixie dust, you know. You can basically sprinkle in some pixie dust in your trees. It's not really called like that, of course. But, like, you can just go here to with statement, and you can say this node needs to have some additional annotation. You can just say, by the way, I want this node to have an additional annotation of a formatter, which lives in codeanalysis.formatting, and just add that annotation to it. What that will do is, like, whatever the rules are that the user has set for where curlies need to go will be invoked to that just that little piece of the document, not the whole document. So we'll take a look at that piece and say, like, let's format that, conform what the user wants us to do with that. And so now my curlies will be in the right place. If I change where I want my curlies to be, and I hit F5 again, so I won't detach the debugger this time. I'll just go back to PowerPoint. But as you can see right now, everything's still working. Hopefully, yeah, here we go. Here's the light bulb moment. We click on the add curly braces, and there we go. We have curly braces being added. Like. So, quite easy to actually build this kind of stuff. Just a couple of lines of code, like, took me 10 minutes, 15 minutes. Actually, I have the debugger attached here. So, like, you know, I can just set breakpoints in here, of course, because I just figured out that my else class is not quite working well. So, like, you know, I don't know what's really going on here, but there's my breakpoint hit in the other instance, and I can figure out, like, what did I do wrong over here. And apparently the syntax kind is not an else class. That's right. It's actually an else keyword. So I could actually restart this thing or make the edits here, and we'll actually see that this thing then works. Like, you know, I just made a little mistake here. So, quite easy. Now, let me wrap up. We have the preview of Roslyn available today, so you can download it, you can play with it, you can install it in Visual Studio and start building your own refactorings, code analyses, all of those things. It's all open source, so you can see how it works as well. Some other things here, just some takeaways. I'm not going to do demonstrations of these. .NET Foundation is a new set of technologies, or actually existing set of technologies that are now being brought much more to the open space, including the .NET compiler platform, of course, but a whole bunch of other things, entity framework, all of the ASP.NET stack. So that's a new initiative. You can read a lot about it on .NETFoundation.org. There's a reference source page that I haven't shown you, but the only thing you really have to remember from that is if you go to sourceof.net, like very simple to remember, sourceof.net literally, you end up in this beautiful browser experience, and this is actually powered by Roslyn. So like, you know, if you go here and you click on a task and you start like navigating interfaces and all of that stuff, find all references, all of that stuff is running Roslyn on the server in ASP.NET, you know, powering the sourceof.net website. So you get syntax highlighting all of that stuff for free using those APIs. So great experience that we can enable using this thing. So if you feel inspired to do something, like this is something that's possible using it. Finally, there's some C# and VB features as well. If you install Roslyn, you will actually get to see a sampler of some of the new things that are available in the languages. That's not a final list by all means. Like, you know, there may be changes going forward, but we are very open about that. You can go to the website there, see the language design notes, what we're thinking of adding to the language, and here's the tentative list of what C# 6 and VB13 will actually look like. So that's a bunch of things. There's also links to the language design notes, which are now also available. We're starting to upload them because we have language design notes all the way back to like 1999 for C#. Like, we're not going to upload all of that stuff in one go, obviously. But you know, all of the language design notes going forward, and we'll start backporting a couple of things, are available on CodePlex as well. So you can sort of like, if you wonder like, why did they choose to make optional parameters using colons as opposed to equal signs to assign default values? Well, the reason will be in there because you know it wouldn't be compatible in this case. So you can find the design rationale in there as well. So not too much time to talk about the C# language features here. So with that, I want to skip over that. We'd love to hear feedback. Quite frankly, a lot of this stuff is all preview technology, new JIT, like, you know, new compilers, like, you know, .NET native, SIMD support, a whole bunch of things here that we really want people to start taking advantage of, taking a look at how it helps your applications, find any pitfalls that, you know, the teams may not have caught yet, and just let us know those kind of things. As you've seen, a lot of features like SIMD, top-rated feature, LOH compaction came into to user voice as well. Go there, you know, upvote things that people say, like, we need this, and you know, the teams are really looking at that list over there as sort of, you know, the North Star of how to implement the next set of features for the next releases. So with that, I'd like to wrap up and thank you once more for your attention. Fill in some evaluations, that kind of stuff, and hope to see you again tomorrow. Thank you.